Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
All right, it is the final November installment of this podcast. It is crazy. We're almost
farewell,
the end
turkey,
of the year.
Turkey week.
Farewell, turkey week. Hello, Santa week.
Gobble, gobble.
Yeah.
No more.
Did y'all have a good Thanksgiving?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Randy, what was the best thing you ate on Thanksgiving?
Probably the ham I got from Mary Stiller Barbecue. It was pretty good. Yeah, although the smoked scalloped potatoes were also quite tasty.
Oh, man. Scalloped potatoes are good stuff.
Yep.
Nick?
Weirdly, it was an heirloom and burrata salad. Heirloom tomato and burrata. Yep. I decided to get a salad at the restaurant I went to, and I decided to go outside my comfort zone, and it was the best thing I ate.
Well, that's pretty bold.
What about you, Dave?
For me, I ate out at a restaurant as well, and I considered getting their turkey plate, which they had, you know, like sort of like you get like a soup and then a main course with turkey and stuffing and all that, and then you get a like pumpkin pie or other kind of dessert.
Sure.
I instead got a steak, and I have to say it was a really good steak.
Okay.
Not like in the amazing level, but I think the previous day I had talked about steaks for some reason, and I was like, that got me hungry for it, and it was very good.
Yeah.
Well worth it. So,
before we get to games and stuff, we want to mention a variant cover policy change.
Yeah.
We posted about this on our Facebook, which mentioned on the podcast as well. Basically, I don't know if y'all have noticed, but comic companies are producing roughly a million variant covers each week.
Yes. Sometimes it's confusing.
A little bit to us, and we work in this industry.
Yeah. Like, I know you've probably seen those covers where it has some cool art, but maybe they've taken the title off
of
it, so you don't know what you're looking at.
Or it's a Moon Knight cover, but it's a Moon Knight cover for Amazing Spider-Man for some reason.
Right. It's because they're celebrating Moon Knight that month, and they're like, every book will get one variant with Moon Knight.
Yeah.
And then also, there's just the... You've probably encountered the thing of, have I bought this yet?
Yep. And so, we feel like it's gotten confusing. And as a result, we're going to be cutting way back in the new year, by which I mean, it just takes a while to catch up. We're already doing it, but it won't be till late December, early January, you'll start seeing the effects of it.
And it's not to say we're eliminating variant covers completely.
No, we would if we could. If I could snap my fingers and go away from variant covers, they'd be gone tomorrow.
Yeah.
But there will be some with, like, some number ones.
Yeah, number ones still have a fair number of jumping on point. You know, they'll do a fair number of covers. Or, every so often, they'll make a cover that's like, we got to order that one.
Right.
Right.
But we're going to try and cut back on the number of variant covers on our shelves.
Right. By and large, it should make it easier to tell what is what, whether if you've bought something before. We'll focus on, you know, we've never been, like, hugely into, like, variant covers, which is why we don't have lots of, you know, there's a few priced up ones each week because we, there are those quite rare ones.
Yep.
But it's not sort of our comfort zone, I guess I'd say, that we like to be in, and we would rather be finding you stories.
Right. And so the upshot of all this is, if you spot a particular cover you want,
yep,
you need to get an order into us, and it needs to be before the final order cutoff date, which is usually 3 to 4 weeks before the comic comes in. It can be longer, but if you spot it, you want to message us and be like, hey, can I get this? And we will look, and if the answer is yes, we will order it for you.
Randy, does that, would include sort of all the baseline ones, but might not include a 1 in 25 or
right.
1 in
and the
50?
Thing is, there are tons of covers online that are like, you know, 1 per 25 copies, you can't hold that one for you, 1 per 50, only done with a particular store. There are stores that do special variants, and like,
store
so, you can't email us and be like, get me this cover. You
gotta
be like,
from Midtown Comics in New York.
You can email us and be like, hey, this cover looks cool, can you get it?
Right.
And we will do our best if we can.
Yes. But I think that this should serve people, and yet you will still be able to, like, we certainly recognize there's cool covers out there, and, like, that it is kind of fun to customize a little bit, but it was getting a little too much, and so, yes, please tell us if you would like to customize your cover.
Because we are starting to go mainly one cover on as many books as possible.
Yeah, and it's going to be the main cover.
All right. Reminder about the White Elephant gifts, we still have those. $20 or $30 gets you a nice pre-wrapped game.
Yep.
Which you can give out to holiday exchanges or just, you know, surprise yourself.
Yeah.
All right. Game-wise, we got Dreams and Machines starter set. This is the new, it looks sort of post-apocalyptic.
Okay.
It is from people who do the Fallout RPG, the Star Trek RPG, mm-hmm. The Warhammer RPG. It's the same publisher, I believe.
So this is a role-playing game, not a board game.
A role-playing game.
What, yes. What's say the name?
Dreams and Machines.
Dreams and Machines. I guess I haven't really looked at this
one. A whole new setting. It's got nice art. People were griping about D&D, and a bunch of people launched their own things, and so they're just...
So now we have options.
Yep.
I need to check this out. I always like to see some good options.
We got Dune Imperium Uprising, which is a standalone sequel to the Dune Imperium deck-building game that Dave and I both played and really enjoyed.
Yep. It's funny, I was thinking, I haven't played the deck-building game, because that is, it's a portion of it, but it's not, like, just a deck-building
game. It's a deck-builder with some other stuff, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a standalone expansion?
It's a standalone, it's called Dune Imperium Uprising. I'm not sure the deal. I saw that there's...
It doesn't require the original?
Does not require the original.
Oh, okay.
It's a new game. But it's in the same vein. It looks very similar to what I've seen it played.
Cool.
It's got a big plastic worm in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
unleash the worm.
Unleash the worm. We got World Wonders, which was my big hit from BGG, which we talked about, but we got that back in.
Cool.
We've got Tiny Epic Crimes, for you like the Tiny Epic games. This is you like, I think, solving crimes mm-hmm. As opposed to being gangsters. Takedo Duo, which is a Tour of Japan game. It's very fun. This is the two-player version of that.
Yep, Takedo's been popular for years and years.
Candela Obscura, which is a new RPG. This is like
from Critical Role.
Critical Role people. Yeah. This was their new podcast where they're eldritch investigators, something like that.
Yeah,
like
I think
Gaslight type thing.
Yeah, I think it's got elements of that and elements of the Feylands and stuff like that. So it's not like, say, strictly Lovecraftian, although it might be tinged
with
that.
Got elements of that for sure.
Yeah, but yeah, we had some interest in that. Several people picked it up right out of the gate. But yeah, if you're looking for like an unusual setting and you like some of the sort of richness of the worlds from Critical Role. Or you just watched those episodes and want to check it out, that book is out.
And then we've got Shadowrun Scotophobia, which is a new Shadowrun villains book.
What's it called?
Scotophobia.
Like fear of Scott?
I don't know what it is. It's just a weird name.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is out of my wheelhouse. I don't know.
And then we got Disney Taboo, which is a classic game. This is a Disney version where like you give your thing and you have to get people to guess the word without saying certain words.
Like, can you guess, Stitch or whatever without saying
Hawaii
or alien or UFO or whatever.
The funny thing is, I think we found we were looking at this like there's like five words you can't say. Like it seems pretty easy to be able to get people. Maybe in the heat of the moment,
you would think. I think we were looking at the one for Moana.
Yeah,
and
like Hawaiian princess was not outlawed. You could say Hawaiian princess,
right? But yeah, like I think. It looked fun though.
Yeah, it looks like a fun game.
If you like that idea, the basic idea, if you played Taboo before, Taboo with Disney themes.
Yep. All right, let's talk about comics for November 29th. Let's start off with Titans Beast World, which is Tom Taylor's new.
It's a spinoff of the regular Titans book.
Yep. This is his first crossover that he's written that's in continuity.
Yep. What's it crossing over between strictly?
A lot of stuff.
Obviously it's going to be in the regular Titans book, but they're all, okay, it's his Nightwing, Action Comics, and a few little mini-series or one-offs of its own.
Right, yes.
But when you say a lot, like, it's not a mega-crossover, the total here is maybe, like, 12 to 15
books. Actually thought it was bigger, it's like a quick little crossover, I thought it was bigger than it is. So yeah, there's several one-shots, which I think you can take or leave, an issue of Action Comics... Couple issues of Titans, couple issues of Nightwing. So it's kind of a Tom Taylor story.
Yeah.
And this is Brother Eternity, the bad guy from Titans, reveals his agenda, and it involves a monster from outer space.
Yep.
And in stopping it, it may be that Beast Boy goes too far.
Right. He's kind of the... It's interesting because he's sort of the man with the plan in this.
Yep.
But the plan requires somewhat extreme circumstances to pull off. They're like... Well, we could do all these like really super dangerous and risky things to deal with it, or we try my plan. And Nightwing, being a cool guy, is like, "We'll back your plan." Although I don't know if that's a great idea. You got to remember, this is a dumb kid. they're showing that's you know, his teammates back him up when they think he's got a good play, but this is still somewhat cosmic stuff that's happening that
it is.
He has to deal with, and yes, the fallout is clearly going to be pretty intense and have far-reaching effects.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like, and Taylor said this on his Facebook, that it is kind of like his bringing deceased and injustice to the DC universe.
Yeah, it kind of feels makes me feel what it is. It's big. It's bold. There's, but there are working in some also threads from other DC continuity.
Yeah,
because there's some big reveals towards the end of this.
That this visual, I'm not going to say what it is and spoil it for people, but that is a pretty cool visual.
It is.
Yeah, there's some real, who's the artist?
Ivan Rice.
Oh, Ivan Rice. Yeah, he's always good. Quick aside, because it's in all the DC books this week, there's a nice double-page tribute to Keith Giffen, who passed away a few weeks ago. It's got a piece of art from Kevin Maguire, who did Justice League International back in the day. It's drawn in that style, and it shows Keith Giffen, just like that JLI number one cover, but surrounded by all of his kind of creations, whether it's Lobo, Ambush Bug, Jaime Reyes, and a bunch of other ones, too. And then there's little remembrances of him on the other page. And it is funny. Like, these are all very sweet and remembrances. But every single one of them is like, you know, he was a big curmudgeon, but he had a heart of gold.
Yep,
oh, he had a crusty style. Oh, he could be kind of jerky at times. It is funny. It's like, there's no doubt that, that who he was who he was. And even the picture of him that Kevin Maguire drew suggests that. But he does sound like a, you know, kind of like a secret sweetheart, and everybody says some nice stuff. Jim Lee, Mark Waid, Dan Jurgens, J.M. DeMatteis, Kevin Maguire, and stuff like that. Jeff Lemire was in there. Pleased to see DC gave a really good tribute to him.
DC also has Batman 89 Echoes, a sequel to the Batman 89 series that original writer Sam Hamm did with artist Joe Quinones. This is a few years later. Batman is missing. Barbara Gordon is police commissioner, and you will see the Batman 89 version of Harley Quinn, who's a like TV personality.
Okay.
And Jonathan Crane, and what exactly is going on with Batman? So it's sort of a weird.
Yep. If you were enjoying the first one, you might want to give a look to this next one.
Marvel is launching their own mini crossover this week called Gang War. That is spinning out Amazing Spider-Man. There's an Amazing Spider-Man Gang War First Strike one-shot that is written by Zeb Wells and Coey Ziglar. And it is basically has all the different gang, like the Owl and Madam Mask and Hammerhead and a bunch of those guys trying to divide up New York City after Tombstone was killed at his daughter's wedding.
Essentially, it creates a power vacuum, and a lot of people want the top role. And there's some interesting sort of maneuvering from the various gangsters. The thing that makes me kind of want to like keep up with this is this is a solid enough first issue for one thing, but but also it has a map like Batman No Man's Land did back in the day. So you see a map of like New York with the various gang territories shown on it, and I imagine with you know each new issue they will probably be showing how that moves around. And that seems like a fun thing. I'm sure at some point one of those guys is just going to get their people completely whacked.
Yep.
And they're just going to go off the map. And stuff like that I think will be fun.
I'm just glad people like the Enforcers get an area.
Sure. Okay. Nice. Yeah.
And also Ringmaster.
Yeah, I saw him in one of the sequences, and I was like, wow.
He's not running a secret circus of crime, he's just running a borough of crime.
Yes, his circus has grown.
He runs numbers and prostitution right now.
Oh, no.
That's the sad truth of it.
But also
he always had a pimp hat, I guess.
But the Owl gets a little piece of the pie, too.
Sure. Owl has always been established as a mob leader.
Sure,
that has been a thing of his, in addition to looking like a weird flying Jack the Ripper.
Some of these people I don't recognize, though. Like Big Ben. Who's Big Ben?
That is a name that has that it's not new, but I think honestly, let's be truthful. I think some of these have been pulled out as cannon fodder. They're going to be the guys who get whacked.
Yep.
Ringmaster is probably going to get whacked.
Are you telling me that the Bumbler, whoever that is
I think the Bumbler probably ain't going to make it.
That's some Dan Slott one issue villain or some other writer who was just very briefly on there.
But
it's you know it's a fun enough plot to see these kind of the colorful mobsters of Spider-Man and another DC other Marvel heroes at each other's throats and trying to puzzle it out. So I'd say it's worth checking out.
There's also two tie-ins this week. There's Luke Cage Gang War, which is a miniseries. Luke Cage, if you don't know, is mayor of New York right now. And he's having to enforce former Mayor Fisk, a.k.a. Kingpin, put a illegal vigilante law in new place in New York, so you cannot be a superhero in New York. And all the villains are taking advantage of it. And Luke Cage, who is, of course, a former vigilante himself, is kind of struggling because he has to be mayor and enforce this law. He can't just repeal it. And it's sort of, this is about his struggle with it. And it pits him up against an unusual Spider-Man villain.
Do you think when Luke Cage ran for mayor that he ran on, like, a policy of giving some oomph to the holidays, making sure it would be, like, say, a sweet Christmas?
No.
I bet he did. That's why he got elected.
Sure.
And then there's...
He wants to make it safe for people to say sweet Christmas again.
Sweet happy holidays, though, not the same.
Yeah, it's not the same.
And then there's a Spider-Woman book launching out of this, which is pitting Spider-Woman against a Luke Cage villain.
Yep.
And also, Spider-Woman got...
there's some
erased.
Hydra stuff in there, too, right?
She got erased from the universe by a magic dagger during Dan Slott's run.
It was Spider-Verse stuff, yeah.
Now she's come back, and there is something pretty notable missing, and she is the only one who remembers it. And it's kind of ties into world continuity. I'm interested in seeing where that goes.
Randy, you and I quite liked the previous run by Dennis Hopeless on that.
Yep, I think that's like three runs back now.
Yeah. Was it?
Yeah. Huh? It's been a ways.
Who was after that?
People I don't remember.
Okay. but this is back in the classic costume, and it will go into, like, it seems like an ongoing series after this.
Yeah.
So if you were looking for some Jessica Drew action.
Yeah. But that's a sort of a strong start for Gang War this week, I thought. Mm-hmm. We've got X-Men Blue Origins, which is a one-shot, right?
It is.
And this is going back at... I don't know if y'all know that... and I know y'all know, but anybody out there knows... that Nightcrawler and Mystique had a sort of... a definite tie-in early on... but then they have sort of a weird, twisted history... as they kept retconning the origin...
Right, were they like brother and sister, mother and son... did she shapeshift, what's going on with that... And it was teased as far back as, like, I want to say roughly 1980.
Yeah, and Chris Claremont had a plan. Like, we know what his plan was... but it was basically a little too progressive for people, and so it got shot down by, I think, editorial or somebody.
Right. I think we can say what that plan was, which in its way works into this, which is that Mystique shape-changed into a man, had a child with her girlfriend Destiny. But in the early 80s, you could only hint at, a gay romance. I guess this will show how far we have come, that, like, it was literally a taboo topic. It could not be brought up. And this story, and it with a framing device I cannot say I really cared for, tries to bring together all of the portions of Nightcrawler's origin and give a definitive origin for Nightcrawler, and Mystique sort of in the process, but mainly Nightcrawler, as relates to Mystique.
Yep.
And, I have to say, when I skimmed it, I was not impressed. When I kind of read it, I was actually fairly impressed with how it pulled everything together, and I thought it kind of did justice to Claremont's ideas, didn't throw out anything that had been brought up before, but, like, there's weird stuff with, like, the demon Azazel.
Yep.
Who had shown up, and I was like, oh, man, I don't want Nightcrawler to be, like, a mystic demon. He's a mutant. Let him be a mutant. And I felt pretty satisfied with how they did it, but Azazel is still part of the story, and Nick, I think you liked it pretty well, too.
I did. I thought it was pretty well handled. It seems that Cy Spurrier, who I think wrote this, has a huge fondness for Nightcrawler, because he's also writing the Amazing
Spider-Man.
Or Uncanny Spider-Man, but he also did the Nightcrawler miniseries... that came before it.
Oh, okay.
So he's definitely been working with this character for a couple of years now. But I felt like this, I mean, is a really good rendition of the relationship between these two characters.
Yeah.
Actually, I guess I would say three characters, because you'd now have to include Destiny in there.
Yep. And there's some things I didn't quite expect would come up, like one of the other distractions in their life, Nick, near the end.
Yeah.
How Xavier is involved, how other past things in Destiny's life are involved, you know, why some things, some stories that were mentioned, brought up, possibilities that were brought up for their connections were proved to be false, and some are true, and all of that stuff. So
I think if you're a Nightcrawler fan, Bird,
you probably got to go ahead and read it, because it's going to stick for a while. Like, I don't see anybody particularly undoing this. I suspect they may not talk about every aspect of it, but this, the basics of this are going to stick.
Yeah, I agree.
Howard the Duck, it is his 50th anniversary? Yes.
That's
and
nuts.
So there is a Howard the Duck one-shot special. The framing device is by Chip Zdarsky and Joe Quinones, who did the most recent Howard the Duck series. And they introduce a character called the Peeper, who is the Watcher's cousin. And he shows Howard what-ifs. Like, what if he had won his bid for the presidency? What if he became an X-Man? What if
Nick, are you aware that in, like, I believe 76 he ran for president?
No.
And like I remember because my brother had a few stray issues of Howard the Duck, and in those issues, like, they had, like, little, like, you can clip and save on the letters page, like, what looked like a little campaign button for it and all that stuff. I think, like, it's like him showed him, you know, in a debate with Jimmy Carter.
I'm sad to say that I never read much in the way of Howard the Duck. My knowledge of Howard the Duck comes from the movie.
Don't be too sad about it, Nick. Because although I did read some of those early ones with him, and Gene Colan drew a lot of those and did an amazing job with it, and they were sort of groundbreaking for having, like, some actual sort of subversive humor and stuff like that, they also, I think, don't hold up great. And I, talking about this with both of y'all off mic, I was like, I don't, like, hate Howard the Duck or anything like that, but for me, he's, like, best as, like, a little kind of weird cameo-type character, kind of like in the movies and stuff.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And, like, I mostly don't need to see much focus on him.
I like that he's out there.
But, yeah, like, yeah. But I'm glad he's out there. People who dig it, enjoy
it. If you like Howard the Duck, this is a goofy, fun little anniversary thing.
Yeah. Howard the Duck, the original Deadpool.
Yeah. Crave is a new book from Maria Lovett. It's an Image book. This makes 2 weeks in a row we've had an erotic thriller comic.
Yeah. I think people may remember Maria Lovett from what was the thing she did with Brian Azzarello?
Faithless.
Yeah, Faithless. Yeah, which was really, really good.
That was really, really good.
This time she kind of is doing writing and drawing.
Yep.
It is about an app that basically you...
Like a hookup app.
Yeah,
like a hookup app.
You post what you want and it tells you how to make it happen.
Yeah, or if it's not possible.
It's definitely sort of sinister.
It is.
Right, and the camera kind of meanders around among a bunch of college campus and amongst these various students who are using it.
It kind of reminds me of a sexed up Blumhouse horror movie.
Yeah, I can totally see that, yeah.
I think her artwork, as always, is stellar.
She's great.
She's
really nice. It's all steamy.
Yeah, she draws the sexy in a very unique way.
I'm curious to find out about what the app means.
Yeah, like
I'm curious to see the answers.
Yeah, there is enough here that I was like, okay, you have me, keep going.
Yeah. And then a couple notable trades I want to mention. Saga Volume 11, we'll catch you up to where Saga is before its most recent break. And Spider-Man by Tom Taylor, which collects his 12-issue Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man run.
Oh, right.
Or, sorry, 14-issue, as well as a War of the Realms Land of Giants one-shot that he wrote.
So War of the Realms. Okay, that was the big crossover with Asgard stuff.
Yep. So if you want to see Tom Taylor writing Spider-Man, and you probably do, you like Tom Taylor, this collects all of it. Nick, I know you've got some other single issues you want to mention.
I just have two, actually. One of them is a pretty big one, which is Predator vs. Wolverine number 3. This is kind of, the first issue was just kind of middle of the road for me, but with every subsequent issue, I've been more and more into this series.
Interesting. Am I correct? The second one issue was the one where it was like a team of Predators versus his, like, what do they call them?
Team X?
Well, it was like the Canadian secret, was it like Weapon H?
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever it was, like, the team that was, like, his team back when it was, like, Maverick and all those
Maverick
guys, right?
Maverick and Sabretooth.
Yeah.
His
90s flashback team to, like, the 70s.
Yeah, them fighting in kind of a jungle. So it definitely felt like a Predator. This one
and
has...
Does this reflect a specific era? Name?
Yeah, so this reflects two time periods. It reflects his time in Japan.
Okay.
And
I believe some
his
Weapon
training
X.
There, and then some Weapon X stuff.
A.K.A. when they made him wear the VR helmet.
Yes. There's just really some cool stuff here. I think Ben Percy is doing is a fun job.
You were showing it to me, Nick, and I was like, oh, that's kind of gory.
Yeah, it is. Which Wolverine should be.
Yeah, well, it can be.
It can be. It shouldn't be. But if you were a fan
Nick
of Barry Windsor Smith.
Nothing but eviscerations.
I was big into the Barry Windsor Smith stuff. What are you
doing? Yeah, yeah.
And then probably the story I never knew I wanted is Flash. The third issue hits this week.
The current Dawn of DC run, which with its, like, supernatural spooky overtones.
Yeah, it's just kind of cool. There's a lot of fun stuff. I like what they're doing with, like, Mr. Terrific, Wally, and
Mr. Terrific is not a traditional crossover person with Flash.
Well, no, but Wally is now working for Mr. Terrific's company.
Okay.
And, yeah, so it's that, dealing with his family, and then just his Speed Force being wonky, and him, like...
The Speed Force is, like, is that the source of whatever the spooky stuff is? Like, there's some...
Yeah, there's, like, different...
It's infected with evil,
Well, there's, like, different entities. There's, like, maybe a new, like, god set that is, like, commanding of the Speed Force, but there's also, like, a devil kind of, like, working its way through. It's...
They should make it the Scream Force.
This is, again, this is Cy Spurrier, so, you know, he's doing stuff at X-Men.
He's a Cy Spurrier fan.
Apparently, all of a sudden...
Spurrier today.
It might help that Mike Deodato Jr. is doing the artwork for this,
for sure.
And it is just gorgeous. There's also a take on Max Mercury here that I think is wonderful.
Uh-huh.
I don't know much about Max Mercury other than he's one of the speedsters. But this new version of him, I think, is fantastic. So, yeah, those are the two I had. Dave, I think you've had a couple, right?
Yeah, I'll mention the miniseries, Alan Scott, Green Lantern. Second issue of that hits. This is one that sort of, I guess, formally merges the Earth 2 Green Lantern elements of his character with the classic JSA Alan Scott that we know from our world, who fought in World War II and stuff like that.
Right.
Primarily, the Earth 2 guy was known for being gay. he was also a, you know, like a lot of superheroes, a captain of industry and all that stuff too. Such a classic superhero thing. Lots of rich guy superheroes.
See on the cover, he is in front of Arkham Asylum.
He is literally in Arkham Asylum for conversion therapy in the
1930s. Oh, jeez.
Yeah. And what's interesting is so he gets outed as gay in the 30s. He's had a relationship with like a soldier who, I guess it would have been World War I? Was supposed to have been?
Had to have been.
I think so, because he's probably supposed to be like himself, like 30, and he would have been like 18 in the war or whatever. Yeah, so, but that guy died, and so he kind of thinks, oh, these guys are looking out for me, this is a good idea. He's kind of confused, and he's willing to attempt the conversion therapy, because he's also like kind of lost his love, and so he doesn't quite have anything to live for, but... This has, like, him is, like, in a wing that is, like, the deviance wing, which is to say anyone who is anywhere on the LGBT spectrum. And it's pretty well handled. Like, it's kind of intense and kind of shows, you know, as you might expect, him going from a little bit of a, I'll give this a shot, to, I think these guys do not have our best interest at heart. And it's sort of narrated and prompted because this is a memory he's having in the early 40s as he's trying to figure out a case. Is his guy Doyby Dickles? Isn't that his sidekick?
That's his dude. That's his
but
guy.
He's just like Derby in this, is what he calls him, because he wears a derby. And he's like,
no, Dave, he wears a doyby.
I ain't gonna say it. No, because the character is actually taken a little seriously, more seriously than this one, even if he does have the thickest of accents. And he's like his kind of tough guy, Brooklyn Powell, who's kind of like, hey, I know you're kind of light in the loafers, but hey, you know, you're not hurting nobody, so what's it to me? I kind of appreciate a guy who's supposed to be both a tough guy and a progressive sort of thinker. He's like, for the era. There's a lot of superhero comics like that. And he's talking to Alan, and Alan is kind of narrating this to him. And in the meantime, there's, like, yeah, some murder mystery stuff going on in the future. This shows in the course of this issue where he gets the lantern, which will ultimately give him his power. But it is a rethink of how he got it, I think. I forget where he originally just... Did he just find the lantern? Is it in a meteor?
Yes, or it's on the tracks of a train somehow. Yeah. I don't know.
And he was, like, a train engineer, which is weird.
But it's not like a traditional lantern ring. It's like a mystical one, right?
That is how it was done, and I don't know exactly where they're heading in this one. Like, will this still be mystical? Could be. Gotham has mystical stuff, Slaughter Swamp, and weird stuff like that. But Anyway, this issue was largely, I guess I'd say, a very personal kind of character-driven issue, and was a good one.
Okay.
Really good art with it, too. And then, as this was a sort of loose tie-in to Beast World, it is one of those facsimile reprints of an old issue of Doom Patrol. It's the one that introduces Beast Boy. Who I was saying the other day, Nick, I spent most of my life thinking of him as Changeling.
Right.
Garfield Logan, to me, was in the... I roughly came in around 1980 or so, when they were... He was a prominent member of the New Teen Titans, but did have a history with the Doom Patrol and stuff going back to before that. Despite the fact that he was, like, 14 or 15, he still had a history with them. They changed the name to Changeling at that point. He started as Beast Boy, became Changeling for, like, about 20 years or so.
Yeah,
and then when the cartoon came along, he became Beast Boy, and I doubt they will ever go back at this point. He's
never,
Beast Boy.
Never back to
Changeling. The cover made me think the Doom Patrol were fighting Mr. Mind.
It's a big old crazy worm man, and the worm man has some great cover copy on this. He's shouting out as he webs them with like a little some weird spinneret from him. He says, "Now that you're trapped in my cocoon, my deadly bees will finish the job." And Worm Man seems to, you see a giant wasp or bee or something coming along. This is apparently the Fantastic Bug Man and his incredible insect army.
Sure. I mean, that seems like a foe that the Doom Patrol would fight.
Absolutely. It's interesting to read, you know, this. The Doom Patrol, I haven't read all of the comic, but they were like weirdo superheroes, but not like quite as like with this sort of punch of like, say, Stan Lee's X-Men, which this was roughly the exact same time. And there is some question about which one was the first team of misfits led by a guy in a wheelchair. But there is kind of a fun camp weird tone to it. Like DC was trying to be kind of like Stan Lee was, where they were like, you know, we're with you, counterculture. But DC's not as good at it in this case, I'd say.
Yeah.
But it has its own charms. I love reading these, their old weird attempts at sort of being subversive.
Is this a Bob Haney?
Let's see. I actually wasn't paying attention to the credits.
He was the guy who wrote the weird kid dialogue in Teen Titans and all that.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, this is an era when they, it seems like, weren't always great about the credits.
Yep, yep.
I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Okay, all right. That covers comics for the week. And we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some news. Okay, so we got a little bit of news to talk about. There's a Cape Fear TV show in the works from Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, neither of whom I don't think have done TV.
No, I mean Steven Spielberg has.
Started on TV.
He did amazing
stories. He also did Amazing Stories. And
Band of Brothers.
I think he produced some stuff, too.
Yeah.
Even that Alien show, was it called Taken?
Oh, but yeah, that's true.
It wasn't.
But he hasn't done TV in a while.
Okay.
Well, Scorsese hasn't done TV at all. You're right.
He probably doesn't believe in TV.
He does now.
I guess so.
I bet he produced something.
I don't know what a Cape Fear TV show looks like.
Well, let's see. So, for people who don't know, Cape Fear was originally a 1960s movie.
Correct.
Had Robert Mitchum as this kind of nasty criminal guy that a prosecutor puts away. But then when that dude gets out of prison years later, he kind of comes and terrorizes the guys and his family. Mm-hmm. And so it's very much a kind of a fear of like home invasions and smart criminals who can get close to you. And so then cut to the 90s version that Scorsese did.
Which is the one I'm most...
Right.
I don't think I've ever seen the 60s one.
The 60s one is great.
I don't either.
The 90s one is very good. And the 90s one is more intense. It's more violent. And what they did in the 90s is to make it a little bit more morally ambiguous. So in that one, where De Niro played the psychopath,
Katie.
Max Cady, a guy who basically is like this... Kind of like he looks like almost like would be like a 50s greaser kind of guy, but like real jacked up. Like he got it like insanely in shape for this, scary tattoos and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is also that he's like schooled himself in prison and now knows like he can the sort of legal outs and stuff that he's got and exactly how far he can go to terrorize this guy without getting in trouble with the law.
Wasn't it dad played by Nick Nolte?
Nick Nolte is the prosecutor, and the twist in this one is that he actually like kind of like forged some evidence or doctored some evidence to make sure he went away.
Right.
And he, you know, like we, the audience, know he's a bad guy. But Nick Nolte did, like, kind of betray his code of ethics. Right. And is he also having an affair?
I feel like I don't remember. I've only seen it the one time.
I believe he's having an affair because that's the same lady that Max Cady goes after, who's the, oh my gosh, I can't, Ileana Douglas? Is that?
I don't know.
Nick, do you know who I'm?
Ileana Douglas is an actress.
It's her.
Okay.
She's the one that he terrorizes to get to Nick Nolte, knowing that he can't say why this is a meaningful person to him, because that would reveal he's cheating on his wife.
What I remember is the Sideshow Bob riff that they did on Simpsons.
Expertly spoofed, yes, because there is a point in which you find out he, like, you using, like, his belt or whatever, like, clipped himself to the underside of the car in Cape Fear, and, like, when his family travels for, like, you know, like, couple hundred miles on vacation
Max
to
Cady goes with
Cape
them.
Fear. That is the old the family place where they would go. Max Cady goes with them. Anyway, it's a very suspenseful movie and all of that stuff.
Have you read the book? Apparently this was based on a book from 1957.
Might check it out. That's pretty close to when the original movie was made. It's fascinating when they... occasionally there'll be something like that, you know, like the movie made of it was like just a year after it. Some famous thing.
Well, I mean, they made a TV show off Fatal Attraction. Which was not a very good one. And they've made a TV show off of Fargo, which is fantastic.
Yep.
Right.
So it could go either way. This does seem like a weird adaptation, but so did Fargo, and it worked.
So I will say that the person attached to this, who is spearheading it, is John D. Or no, it's the guy who ran Hannibal.
Oh. Okay.
Well, Nick Anoska, he worked
not,
on the
not
act.
Brian Fuller.
Not Brian Fuller, but one of the other people who worked on the act in Hannibal. He's basically apparently been obsessed with this story, both the novel and both movie adaptations. So he's going to like utilize aspects from various things to sort of form his own story.
It's interesting because, like, as a story, I'm like, it's a good movie.
But it's a kind of like, done in one.
It doesn't seem like a fascinating story to adapt to a TV show.
Right.
But I guess if, like, that's his thing, we'll see.
I think you could probably do it.
Well, like you can extend what, like, this guy terrorizing the lawyer guy and his family. He could go after other people.
So
he also, by the way, it could fill out his story. It might be like, Max Cady is almost always this, like, just terrifying force, almost in the same way Anton Chigurh is in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's like, does this have an interest in showing how did he get this way? I don't know.
Maybe. So the loadout for it is a tense contemporary thriller that examines Americans' obsession with true crime in the 21st century. In it, a storm is coming for a pair of married attorneys when an infamous killer from their past gets released after years in prison.
So, like, they're both going to be involved.
Is it possible that what gets Cady released is sort of like a podcast, like the Serial?
Yeah, he didn't do it.
Although I would think that they wouldn't be so overt as to say, like, these podcasts shouldn't be free and these dangerous criminals.
Yeah, maybe so. What if it's the origin story of Cape Fear itself, and it's going to tell the story of
the founding of it by Puritans?
Was this true? I never knew this. The original film in 1962 was directed by J. Lee Thompson from storyboards devised by original director Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, huh.
It's not something I'm aware of.
It feels Hitchcockian. I mean, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, Hitchcock was great at just doing kind of the simple story,
Well, Nick,
release killer goes after seems like kind of his thing.
While we await this, I would highly suggest watching the original.
Okay.
It's a better overall story and a better presentation of it than the 90s
I like Robert Mitchum.
But it is like, you know, it's less intense and violent, of course. It's not as violent as Scorsese.
Are
what
you
a shock.
Me that yeah, I was going to say.
But I think it's a better movie, and like the implications are all still there. There's creepy implications, even in the 60s movie, about this... this guy and the guy's like teenage daughter, and it's still very unnerving.
But I think a new story could be taken from this.
It's always possible. There's stuff where I'm like, this show shouldn't work that it became a favorite show. So I'm always willing to give it a shot.
Yeah.
There's been the Marvel stuff has been having some ups and downs.
Yep.
And one of the things that the Avengers Kang Dynasty, which we were speculating about, like, are they even going to make this? Apparently it's still on track, because even though they fired Jeff Loveness, who wrote Quantumania,
they have now hired
Michael Waldron, who was writing Avengers Secret Wars, to do Avengers Kang Dynasty. Michael Waldron is the guy who co-created and wrote a lot of Loki Season 1.
Yep.
He was not heavily involved in Season 2, but he is, you know, he was involved.
He's a producer.
Wait, did you say he was the guy who wrote Secret Wars that nobody liked?
No, he hasn't written anything yet. He's going to write the Secret Wars movie.
Secret Wars, not Secret Invasion.
Not Secret Invasion.
I forgot. Marvel really loves that word.
Yeah, they do. See, Secret is their crisis.
Yeah.
So, Michael Waldron is a former Rick and Morty writer.
I did not know that.
He's written Loki. He's written a lot of stuff. He's a good writer.
Yeah.
And I think having the same writer write the two Avengers movies is probably a good thing. That worked out previously.
Yep.
So, ultimately, I think this is all good news. What is interesting to me is that, like, I thought they might be doing, like, a wholesale revision of the whole plan. And it sounds like they're not, if they're still planning on doing Kang Dynasty and Secret Wars.
We'll see.
In a way, it makes sense, like, to... As with the comics, in some ways the characters are bigger than the actors and the directors and everything else is the... And so if there is momentum to set something up, it probably needs to happen even if it, even if they recast or something like that.
I don't think they're going to recast.
Yeah, well, you know, what's that guy's name?
Jonathan Majors,
yeah. I think at this point most everybody knows about his issues.
Yeah.
But also, was he... I don't know. Did it go to trial?
I don't know.
I mean, like, I think I don't it's know that he was so for... much.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if he was exonerated so much as maybe they
he
recanted.
He seems very confident that he's going to be exonerated.
Yeah,
which I don't know if that's just a good lawyer and PR team or what.
Yeah, I'm a little hesitant. I'm honestly usually ready to believe the worst of dudes.
Yeah,
I mean it's still in court right now.
But you know, you also do want to be careful because there's the there can be a tendency to jump the gun and go after people of color. So the guy does deserve his fair shake and if he's merely normal Hollywood over the top, maybe a little
he's just a jerk,
lecherous and jerky or something like that, but not a terrible person, truly terrible person, then he should get the job back.
I guess we'll know soon because the trial starts tomorrow.
Oh, well, there we go.
All right.
And we're going to be there, right?
Yeah, we're going to be on the scene.
Somebody got us tickets, right?
Uh-huh. There are no... That's not how trials work. There are no tickets.
Oh, so you get the tickets there.
Yep.
Buy them at the door.
Like old school movies.
Yeah, you buy them at the door. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought. Thanks.
Yep. Uh-huh.
So, by the way, we meant to mention the store's probably going to be closed tomorrow because we're going to be at...
We're going to be at the trial with the tickets that we're going to get at the door.
We want to... You know how the ending of Endgame, how exciting that was?
Yeah.
Like, we want it to be like that in the courtroom.
It's really going to be...
Woo-hoo-hoo! Yeah. Instead, we're going to get Big Head Corey Stoll.
If they do, should they recast him, I think Kang is a character who presents you opportunities to make that work.
Yeah.
And so they probably could pull that off, too.
They could make him a big space lizard.
I am not the biggest fan of Kang, but what do y'all think? Character-wise, could it be done?
Yes. Yeah,
absolutely.
Easily.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about This is Spinal Tap, a movie that I'm not sure any of us have a particular fondness for.
I use references from it all
the time.
It's like
the one Rob Reiner movie I haven't seen.
Oh, you've not seen it?
No.
I saw it once.
I had the feeling it wasn't going to quite be for me.
I think that's correct. I believe that's correct opinion.
So the chances of you watching a sequel that you've never seen the original
extremely low.
Yep. Same. But they are filming a sequel to This is Spinal Tap, so...
Which is weird.
For those of you who are not ancient... This is Spinal Tap was like kind of one of the first breakout mockumentaries.
Yep.
It was a documentary of a Led Zeppelin-esque hard rock band.
Yep. They were all
called
idiots.
Spinal Tap. They're all idiots. They're stupid, like goofy British, somewhere between pretentious and like dumb stoner.
Yep.
I know there's funny scenes in it. I've seen bits and pieces of them here and there, and songs that they wrote original songs for it that are intentionally goofy songs.
Yep.
But I believe the documentary part is played straight.
Yeah.
It's like the comedy comes from playing it straight. And so Rob Reiner, who's got to be, 1,000 years old?
Pretty much, a little bit, yeah.
And by the way, who in the 80s, I think, made some of the greatest movies of all time.
Yep. Yeah.
Stand By Me, Princess Bride.
Harry Met Sally?
When Harry Met Sally. Misery, that was 1990, but I'm going to call it 80.
Yep.
The Few Good Men, right?
Throw Mama from the Train.
That wasn't one of them. That wasn't one of them. But
that was him, though, wasn't it?
Was it him?
I don't think so.
Okay.
If anything else, that might have been like a Danny DeVito directed thing.
That seems possible, yeah.
He was in it. But anyway, an impeccable track record in the 80s,
yep.
More checkered after that.
Yep.
But like, obviously, one of the great talents of our time, to be honest.
Now you say that, you say more checkered, but I'm like, I feel like he had a pretty good
Dave,
run.
Dave, he did also one of your big movies, Misery.
I said Misery.
Did you? Okay, oh, I missed that one.
Now I'm kind of curious to see what else Rob Reiner has.
I actually consider them to have made the two best Stephen King adaptations with Misery and Stand By Me, both kind of unconventional.
How dare you,
King.
Sir? Mike Flanagan would slap you silly if you were
His
here.
Movies are better than
and
Flanagan's.
Danny DeVito did direct Throw Mama from the Train.
Yeah, y'all probably shouldn't question me.
Well, he just finished a movie.
Go and defend North? Is that what's coming
no,
up?
No. I would never defend North. but he just finished up that James Brooks documentary kind of thing that I really want to watch put on Max.
You know what it was? He teamed with Sorkin and did A Few Good Men and then American President back-to-back.
Yes.
Which is not back-to-back. It was 92 and 95, but pretty close.
Yep.
I like American President.
That was... North was right there in the middle, so I guess we were hitting the nadir. And then beyond that, I don't believe there's anything. I never saw Ghosts of Mississippi. But I believe as I look through his filmography from there, I don't see anything great.
But he's a guy who could make bad movies or no movies for the rest of his life, and he still would have like changed the shape of movies.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Rob Reiner wants to make this Spinal Tap sequel. I'm not going to see. Go for it.
It's a little like the Mel Brooks History of the World stuff.
Yeah, do what you want.
How did that pan out?
It was solid. It was okay. Solid. It had some moments.
His TV show.
Yeah. A lot of people worked on it because they wanted to work with Mel Brooks.
And I bet Spinal Tap will be something of the same kind of thing.
There'll be a lot of people in it like, that guy's in that movie?
It'll be funny. And I think I saw that there's like a few kind of big stars are going to be like Garth Brooks and some other kind of notable celebrities are going to show up as like so that they can do the stuff that we've kind of become used to, I guess, with shows like Extras and things like that.
Is Garth Brooks a notable or famous person?
If you want to talk about... honestly, these are probably supposed to be like... washed up stars of the 70s and 80s.
Okay.
And I think Garth Brooks could fit right in there with them.
Yeah, that works.
But also, he's probably one of the biggest selling country acts of all time.
That's true.
And I bet could sell out a stadium faster than
he's got friends in love. No, I'm going to do it. I'm going to open a trial and I'm going to sell out that stadium.
we're gonna finally get into the big stadium trials like we've been wanting to do. And we're going to be able to charge so much for these trials.
Oh, yeah. People are going to love it.
I can't wait.
Scopes Monkey Trial Part 2.
And it all starts with our attendance of Jonathan Majors' trial tomorrow.
Anyway.
What I want to get is one of those, like, rumble seat things that they do.
So when they...
You want a D-box for
your... When they say objection, like, your seat rumbles?
Yeah.
and shimmies to the left.
Anyway.
What were we talking about?
Nothing.
This is Spinal Tap 2, right.
The last thing... there is an Alien series, the movie Alien, the series of Alien, Aliens, all that stuff.
Yep.
Yes.
There's a TV series coming from Noah Hawley, who has done only great TV.
Fargo. We've talked about this series before he was maybe attached to it before, right? Like, we knew they were doing an Alien.
We knew they were doing an Alien series.
Like, for 2 years, I think
we knew he was attached to it. Nick and I both forgot.
Yes.
But he has done only great TV. He did Legion, he did Fargo, he's been attached to a bunch of great stuff.
Yeah.
And they announced a little casting. Tim Oliphant is going to be in it.
Yes.
I think that is a huge asset.
For sure. He's going to play the alien, I assume. I'm Tim Oliphant.
He's going to give a little bit of Texas drawl to the alien.
Finally
the aliens talk.
Timothy Oliphant is going to be known to most people from, what's his show?
Justified.
And then on Star Wars.
Cobb Vanth.
On Mando.
Who's alive, but I don't think we're ever going to see him again.
I wouldn't say that. He's probably a big fan of Star Wars.
You know, that guy's got to eat someday, Randy. He's going to need a new deck.
He'll come back as Cyborg Cowboy.
Maybe so.
Maybe my most hated Star Wars character.
But last we knew, he got tagged by, what, Hondo?
Hondo.
Who was it? Who? New dude?
No.
Was it?
It was Hondo.
No, it wasn't Hondo.
Hondo's the pirate.
It's Cad Bane.
Cad Bane.
Not Han.
Right. Okay. Yeah,
we're Star Wars fans. We can't.
It was one of those cartoon things that nerds like. But Timothy Olyphant, great actor. He was also on Deadwood.
Yep.
And the
semi-horror comedy on Netflix with Drew Barrymore.
I think he's kind of... Oh, yeah. The Diet. Santa Clarita Diet.
Yes, which was great. Yep.
Yeah. I think he's the kind of character actor you want on an alien show where he's got some star power oomph.
Yeah.
But he also he's just a good actor. I mean... And he's good at playing, I think, kind of like... I don't know what this show is going to be about, but I feel like he could both play the kind of blue-collar side that they sometimes portray in alien movies, as well as potentially a more corporate side if that's the role they want.
I feel like kind of a Tom Skerritt kind of character.
Yeah. Absolutely. He's Tom Skerritt 2.0.
We don't know too much about this series, right? Like what the actual thing is going to be?
I feel like it's come up before, but I feel like it might have been so hazy and in the past that like it was just bouncing around.
I want Noah Hawley to do a different take on Alien, though.
Are we ever going to get the Alien takeover of Earth kind of thing?
I mean,
the obvious like infestation that runs wild. Because I think that, you know, the same way the Sarah Connor Chronicles kind of parsed out. So that wasn't just Skynet goes online, end of world.
Yeah.
Instead, it's like, oh, there's a slow build-up to it, which, if they were doing it right now, would 100% be all involved with AI.
Yeah.
But at the time, there was chess computers and other, like, computers that they were working on in the 2000s that were, like, integral to its creation, and she was having to deal with it on a more compartmentalized, smaller level that I thought was pretty cool. And so, likewise, it's like it's not like there's a binary where Earth is either perfectly fine or completely taken over by aliens. It could be like they get loose in some country, they get loose in Australia or whatever, and it's like, do we nuke Australia? Does it become a no man's land? How long will they live without human hosts? They could start getting into some of those weird nitty-gritty details as people on Earth are trying to figure it out, and there's some other situation going on that makes it all particularly pressing.
Dave, let's be honest. If there were xenomorphs in Australia, I don't think it would move the needle. There's some weird creatures down in Australia.
You think it'd be like the xenomorphs got killed by some kind of desert tarantula?
Yeah. The xenomorph would show up and like a koala would drop on it. Predators ain't got nothing on koalas.
I like the idea of Earth getting taken over. I think you could do something different. I know you have to have people find eggs infest humans, and you get... The aliens.
People look in the alien thing and they get an alien in their face. It's a thing
but,
that happens.
But
they
if can you also, could somehow like change that up a little bit.
Well, you know, the first Dark Horse comic I read was a very moody story by Mark
Verheyden,
done in black and white with the zip tone shading that looked really cool. And it was about it was weirdly serious about a grown up Newt who was also spaced out on like drugs. She was like, you know, taking all these antidepressants and stuff and like was very out of it. And it was weirdly serious about that. I think that was to its quality, I think. But in that, like, Weyland-Yutani, even if maybe they just called him the company in that, they had access to it and had like gotten some eggs somehow, and they were like on Earth, and or maybe a ship crashes on Earth, I forget what, but I'm like, you could have it so that, you know, oh, for 10 years we've been we've had these, we've figured out how to like, you know, put implants in these things, and we turn them loose on rogue countries and terrorists that we don't like, and they die within a few days, and they're just like ridiculously dangerous, but the bodies degrade so they can't pin it on us. You know, you could have something as specific as that.
Yeah.
I think they could find it. I know that the money men probably are always like, we want them to look into an egg leaps onto the face, and they want all the greatest hits.
Yeah.
You know, and it's loose in a ship, and it's all that.
But the thing is, that's not what Hawley does. Hawley is always able to do homage to the original, but with a new twist.
Right,
I think his involvement here makes me think that we'll get something different.
Right, we will get something where we probably can't quite anticipate it. It'll be weird like that.
Yeah. All right, let's jump over and talk about some of our topics for the week. Let's talk about Scott Pilgrim Takes Off, the Netflix anime of Scott Pilgrim.
Okay.
Which turned out to be different than what we thought it was, and in some ways poorly advertised because it did not give any indication of what was so different about it.
I think it was deliberately done. I think they didn't want people to know, but it is weird because I almost didn't watch it.
Yeah,
right.
And then I watched last week, I watched a couple episodes, Nick had watched half of it, I think.
I've watched 6 of the 8.
So, but last week, did you watch 6 or you watched, like...
Yeah, I watched 6.
So, we were under the impression it was an adaptation or, like, just an expansion on the movie.
Well, even the trailer made it seem that way.
Yeah, and so I watched 2 episodes and I was like, I don't know if I'm feeling this. And then I went back and watched episode 3, which hooked me, and then I watched the remainder of the... So I watched all of it. But I guess the key thing to know, and this is a bit of a spoiler, is that at the end of episode 1, which is the closest thing to the comics or the movie, it's very similar in tone.
Yeah.
Slightly changed, like Roxy, or not Roxy, Ramona is delivering for Netflix instead of Amazon. So this is a period place where she's developed, delivering Netflix DVDs.
Right.
And, Kim Pine works in a video store.
Right.
But Matthew Patel shows up and Scott apparently gets killed at the end of that fight.
Yep. He does not beat Matthew Patel.
Matthew Patel wins and then he goes back and
I assume killed in that cartoony way that everybody
does. He gets smashed and there's coins left.
Yeah, but not a lot of coins. So he's not like a really high level.
Right. I'm going to guess that perhaps we haven't seen the end of him, but it's not. But yeah, that's quite the direction change. Yep.
And then Matthew Patel challenges Gideon for leadership of the Evil X's.
Yep.
And Ramona is hunting. She finds out that Scott's not dead.
Right.
And begins hunting to figure out what happened to him. And she is the one who sort of confronts all her evil exes.
Yeah.
And it's not always fights. Sometimes it's just like two people realizing, you know, that she owes an apology to them or something like that. It's weirdly, it's more mature.
It is more mature.
It's also still like, I mean, she and Roxy have a fight in a video store where they crash through various movies.
Yep.
So there's still that kind of heightened anime, level to it. I watched like 10 minutes of it just to see what the aesthetic and vibe was like. Yep. And, you know, this is, like you said, this is the stuff that does look most like the movie. But I was pretty impressed with the animation and look of it.
The animation is really good.
Like the look of, what, Toronto?
Yeah.
Probably where it is.
The opening is very, very much anime. Like the song.
I skipped that opening every time.
Oh, did you?
Yes,
I did. Oh, no, I had to listen to it.
I think that's part of the appeal of it. But also, like, it's not... The show isn't really anime. Like, yes, it has anime tropes in it, but it's like, nobody would describe the movie as anime. It just would say, you would say it has anime-esque fights.
This is closer to being anime vibes than Scott Pilgrim and either other one.
Yeah.
So
it's a distinct take on it.
It is my least favorite Scott Pilgrim adaptation, but I still quite liked it.
And all the people come back to voice all the same people. I mean, Chris Evans is Lucas Lee, and...
There's a super fun running thing. I think this is a pretty important thing, that young Neil... writes a screenplay, or actually his sleep paralysis demon writes it.
Yes. Is that the lead singer?
No, it's like the intern.
Yeah, he's like the intern.
Okay.
He writes a screenplay, his sleep paralysis demon writes a screenplay that is Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So basically, they're making the movie that we saw.
Right.
That is a version of where Scott beat Matthew Patel. So the movie is, within the anime, a movie. Except it doesn't get made.
No.
But they're making it, and they cast Lucas Lee as Scott.
Yes.
And Envy Adams as Ramona.
Ramona.
Which is great.
And then Ramona plays
Ramona
her stunt
comes
double.
In to play her own stunt double, yes. There's some really funny sort of meta gags
the
in all
Wallace
of this.
Well stuff, like, the cracked
Wallace
me
stuff is great,
up.
Yeah.
Kieran
Culkin was one of the highlights of the movie, and he's great here.
Like, him coming on set and be like, you can't be me.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm me.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun, and as it goes on, it gets weirder and wilder, and I wound up really enjoying it.
Standalone season, multiple
seasons. There's no way they could do more of this.
Well, they've outright come out and said that this was just going to be a one-season thing.
I don't know what they do.
But they said that if they thought
is
of
it
something...
Done? Did you say...
The story ends at episode 8.
Okay.
Very, very strongly ends.
But this was written by Brian Lee O'Malley and one other guy.
Yeah,
and
makes
they,
sense.
And
it
they
feels,
were like...
It this, feels like what you would do if you were Brian Lee O'Malley and you had, like, it was like 10 years later...
Well, it's also, I mean, there was a little bit of fan outcry because this wasn't, like, the original Scott Pilgrim story, and Scott got thrown
was
aside.
There?
There was some dissent because I saw Brian Lee O'Malley get asked about it, like, if this was his idea, and he was like, no,
I
this
saw,
is totally
like,
my
the,
thing.
The worst man babies in existence when, like, not for this, but rather for the Masters of the Universe show because it had a focus on, like, Tila.
Oh, so focusing on Ramona Flowers.
Focusing on Ramona Flowers is going to put some people off. Which is funny because, like, the most legit criticism against the thing was, like, how kind of male-centric it is and how it's kind of very much is about, like, you know, in the same way that Why the Last Man from Brian Vaughn was about these sort of kind of mediocre, schlubby dudes, and their personal growth or whatever, but it's, which I think those are very legit stories to tell, yeah. But they do kind of tend to marginalize the women a little bit in those things. Even with good writers,
yeah.
You sometimes do it. And I think he's probably grown and developed some since then. He's heard the criticism. His second book called Seconds was about a woman, yeah. And like that was probably like 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it makes sense that he would do that. But I also am not surprised at all that essentially there's a Scott Pilgrim bro community,
yes.
That would freak.
Yeah. Anyway, it's super fun. I recommend it. Dave, you got a chance to catch up a little bit on Mark, Legacy of Monsters?
Yeah, y'all talked about this last week, was it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so this is the, you know, this is the Godzilla TV show, but, you know, Godzilla without Godzilla. It's the, it's the S.H.I.E.L.D., Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or whatever.
I mean, there are kaiju.
Right, but it's like they punctuate stuff. They tend to, like, have brief glimpses of them in an episode, and it's more about, like, the fallout and effects of them.
And Godzilla does show up in the episode.
The thing that I kind of didn't know, even from y'all talking about it, and I was enthused based on what you said, was that the writing is really pretty good.
It is.
Like, there's some character subtlety in it that's very impressive. I was talking to it with my brother when we were watching about how, like, who's Kurt Russell's son?
Wyatt Russell.
Russell. Actually, like, how kind of casually good he is at playing a kind of young buck soldier, you know,
mm-hmm.
Who's, you know, well-meaning, but, like, the first time he meets Dr., I can't say her name.
Right.
And is, like, surprised, A, that he's supposed to escort an Asian woman, B, that a woman could be a doctor and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And he keeps putting his foot in his mouth, but it actually doesn't happen quite in that sort of slapsticky way that movies do to be like, oh.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of that, but it's actually handled kind of realistically.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that was actually a good little scene. Or the scene where the creepy dude from Monarch, I don't know what ultimately becomes of him, but like the dude who's like trying to scarily track people down in Tokyo.
Like in 2015, yeah.
Yeah, 2015 in the present.
He's one of those character actors that is really
good. He's
good.
Yeah.
When he shows up and like starts kind of like becoming progressively more creepy to the woman when she's like, she recognizes she doesn't want to be in the situation, but at first he's just like, oh, I'm just a random guy. And he's like, okay, we know that you got into our, like, Monarch files.
Yeah.
And he's like, we need to talk before you do get into trouble. And then she's like, I need to make a call. And he's like, okay, let's us go make a call or whatever. And there was like, oh, the subtle way he's like very clearly trying to control her and manipulate her. And she's also aware of it. Was pretty impressive.
Sorry, I had to look up where I knew that guy. His name is Joe Tippett, and he was a pretty pivotal role in Mayor of Easttown, which was a great story. But yeah, he's great in this. He's as kind of like a very creepy, overbearing. Well,
you know what's funny is he looks like the dude who's Economos in Peacemaker.
Yeah, he does.
Which
yeah.
is to say, Economos is like a schlub who you're definitely not afraid of in Peacemaker.
But this is
a guy who, even though he's not physically intimidating whatsoever,
he's an intimidating schlub.
He has the intimidating quality of like a CIA guy.
Yeah.
And but yeah, the show as you guys said, you know, fluctuates between a few different eras, but. Primarily 1940.
50s.
Yeah, they jump around a little bit in their past. There's two different eras.
There's 52 and 59.
52 and 59. Yeah,
52 and 59. And then 2015.
And then in 2015.
Yep.
Yeah,
because that was the year the actual Godzilla San Francisco attack.
Right. And I like how, you know, you talked about Randy, how like even though we are not the biggest fans of some of these Godzilla movies.
Yep.
Like, it kind of made you want to go back and maybe look for a little bit more of a charitable interpretation because it's so well written. And, like, the way they talk about, like, do they call it like G-Day or what do they call it, like...
It is something like... Isn't it called G-Day?
I think it is.
It might be. Oh, yeah. Basically, when he attacked San Francisco and the way that she's portrayed as having PTSD from it, and they show this really dramatic sequence.
they kill a busload of kids.
They absolutely do.
Yep.
And it was, like, a well-done sequence. But there's like, I was like, oh, there's some serious stuff about PTSD in there. Oh, there's some serious stuff about what, you know, the fallout is when these guys keep two different families and have two different wives in secret, which is a real thing that happens. Cool.
And then there's a cab driver who was talking about how like the all the Godzilla preparations conspiracy thing.
Man, I laughed when at the end of this his conspiracy rant, he's like, "I have a podcast." Like, oh my god!
But it was cool to see all in the airport, all like the Godzilla like evacuation zones.
Yeah,
and things
you guys
like
were
that.
Telling me how they had done a good job of sort of some the guys who made the guy who made the first Monsters movie and who made Rogue One. Whoever that dude is.
Yeah.
Gareth Edwards?
Gareth Edwards.
Yes. Yeah.
He kind of, I think, pioneered thinking about that. I'll give him credit on that in his movie Monsters. But there's signs up on the wall that show you, like, you know, if, you know, it's in Japanese, but it's very clear. It's like, if there's a, you know, a Godzilla or a kaiju attack, take shelter here. And there's a drill that happens in the first episode where everybody goes underground, and I was like, oh, is this going to be an actual thing? Oh, no, it's actually a drill. Mm-hmm.
But I also thought that the...
But she has a panic attack down there because of her memory of this kid, busload of kids dying. I was almost the only... I don't even know if I'd say it's a criticism, really, but it is tonally more serious and realistic than those Godzilla movies. And I was like, I don't know how well it fits...
Well, the first one is it's very much in line with the first one.
I suppose so. I guess I would just say the writing is better. Like, I think the show's writing is decidedly better than
The first one is Gareth Edwards, and it is, like, it is his thing.
I know, I don't like Gareth Edwards.
Me neither.
I do.
Rogue One is, like, I think got hammered into shape and it, like, has some good scenes, but it's just a mess.
I believe that Monarch has better writing than any of his movies.
I think Tony Gilroy, I think, did some saving work on Rogue One, too.
Including Skull Island, which I liked Skull Island, but Skull Island is not... This is what I wanted out of Monarch. This is what I wanted out of this MonsterVerse.
I think some people will be, although there is monster stuff in both the episodes I've seen. I haven't seen the third episode.
There's some notable monster stuff later on.
Yep. There's. Do you feel... Randy, you're not too bothered? Like, cause some people are like... Get to the monster shit.
Yeah, Godzilla I understand
movies.
That.
And this is very clearly not supposed to be that kind of show.
What's funny is, like, in the movies, yes, I want them to get to the Godzilla stuff.
Is it because the human stuff is so dumb?
On the show, it makes more sense to do it at this level. And because it is about Monarch, not about Godzilla,
right?
It works for me.
Yep. And Monarch is an interesting sort of gray area thing where it's both creepy and cool at times.
This is like a conspiracy spy thriller. It's like... conspiracy theory or one of those things.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's monsters.
Right. It has some energy and chases and things like that, and people...
Monarch still has to operate in the dark as opposed to once it finally gets to the Rise of the Monsters, which is, like, after 2015.
Right.
They have to, like, come out and they're like, we know about all these... There's, like, 30 or so of these titans that are just running around.
In the past flashbacks, there's cool stuff, like, among the memorable monster-y scenes is... there's a big old, American, like, battle cruiser ship that's, like, in the middle of, where are they, the Philippines? Like,
Philippines.
And it's, like, in the middle of land that, that got there that one of the guys who was in the Navy knows about. It's got, like, eggs or something in it from, like, kaiju, and we at the very end of the episode, you see a kaiju. You'll also get fascinating stuff like the arrival of Kurt Russell in a really great way.
Kurt Russell's first scene is so good.
Is at the end of the second episode. So far I'm really enjoying it. I'm looking forward to seeing the third. I really wanted to watch it, but we were both too tired. I was just like, nah, two is going to have to be it. Pleased that this one came off, it seems like. It's a good example of how you can take a TV show of something that... You shouldn't be able to, in a way, do on a budget.
Yeah.
Although it's not, like, cheap.
It is very expensive.
When there are kaiju in it, they look really good. The monsters, there are two monsters that are in the...
Apple just has to sell a few...
John Goodman sequence in the first
Apple
episode.
Apple just has to sell a few cases of phones, and they can pay for it.
They're good.
Nick, you'll get a lot of Amazon stuff on your doorstep. You're subsidizing this.
Amazon's not... This is Apple.
This is Apple.
Oh,
this
Apple,
is straight
that's
up...
Right.
That they,
that's right.
Basically, they can just do advertisements for phones. Why are they making television?
They make Killers of the Flower Moon, and they're making the next Matthew Vaughn movie. They're expanding.
I don't understand it.
Me neither.
They have a very weird relationship that some of their stuff is fantastic, and some of it is like, why are you making this?
Yeah.
But, you know, sure. I'll take a good Godzilla, and I will confirm that the third episode is just as good.
Cool. Looking forward to it. How long is it going to be?
Eight, probably.
But it's not standalone, right? Or is it?
I don't know.
Okay. There's talks of a second season, but nothing confirmed.
We'll see how it does.
The first of three Doctor Who specials came out.
Right.
On Disney Plus.
There are going to be three linked specials, I think, all reuniting David Tennant and Donna... Well,
Donna Noble.
The Doctor, yep, as played by David Tennant, was that 10th Doctor?
Yes.
Yes.
And Donna Noble.
Yep. This first one is called Doctor Who and the Star Beast. It is based on a comic, popular Marvel Doctor Who comic,
yep,
by Pat Mills and Dave Gibbons.
Yeah, I wonder if that Dave Gibbons kibble ever amount to anything.
I was not aware of this. I looked up some of the panels from it, uh-huh, that it was Dave Gibbons. The Meep is very, very close to what he was.
Yeah. It
was.
Yep. And he was interesting. Good art. I looked at just one or two panels, but it was pretty impressive.
So, after Jodie Whittaker's Doctor began regenerating, she regenerated back into David Tennant, which is weird. That's never happened.
Yes, never happened.
Right. Generally, and you get a new form when the Doctor goes to a new gen.
And we know that Mkutigatwa is going to take
correct
over.
Correct.
And so this is just like a three-episode. It feels Russell T. Davies is coming back. It almost feels, especially in this episode, at this is Russell T. Davies being like, yeah, I did a crappy thing to Donna, and I need to fix it.
Right. And it is of course, it's also an ongoing mystery that will be revealed all in its entirety, I'm sure, as to, like, exactly why he was reborn.
Yeah.
Because they didn't explain
they
that
did
in
not
the first issue, or first episode.
But they did.
But it is a standalone story.
It is a standalone story. In fact, I don't think, I've not watched Doctor Who since, I watched the first couple episodes of Jodie Whittaker's run and the first couple episodes of Capaldi, but I really haven't watched a lot of Doctor Who.
And you don't need to have, as long as you presumably like the idea of Doctor Who.
Especially if you like Donna, if you like that era. Yeah.
Last night I posted that I had really liked this on Facebook, and one of our former staffers, Roxy, posted, and she's like, do I need to know anything about the going into this? And she's like, I'm a couple seasons behind. And I was like, man, I'm like five seasons behind.
I don't think you do. I think you can...
I think other than knowing that David... he's regenerated back into the 10th Doctor. Yeah. I think is a pretty...
And so what I'll say is, like, the first first minute or two of it, they essentially recap all of that.
Yeah.
So, like, there's literally nothing you need to know.
Yeah,
again,
true,
assuming that you are at least some stripe of fan of Doctor Who and maybe have probably have seen the David Tennant Donna Noble episodes. I was like, not like super enthused, but I'd been hearing good buzz, and you know, I was like, man, I know that when I like Doctor Who, I actually have a really good time with it. I'm the most casual fan you could ever have.
Yeah.
And so I went into it kind of a little half interested, and then like within about 10 minutes, I felt a surprisingly strong emotional connection to it. As we catch up, and, you know, of course, the basic premise of this was that Donna Noble, because of events that happened last time we saw her, had sort of had to have the knowledge of the Doctor expunged from her memory because various sci-fi stuff was going to happen, and she would die if she ever remembered him. And so he had to say goodbye to the person he kind of considers his best friend over the years. Not a romantic interest, but a best friend.
Yep.
And the person who she would call him out on his shit.
Yep.
And so what does he do? He runs right into her, of course, in such a way that he's like, is something going on here?
Yeah.
Is something trying to manipulate
us? Like the TARDIS actually takes him to her.
Yeah. And
she is now married. She has a teenage daughter.
Yep.
Who is trans.
Yep.
And who's named Rose, and the Doctor react, and he's like, what?
Yeah. his kind of baffled reactions are fantastic. It's one of the things the Doctor is best at, is being sort of surprised.
Yeah.
And Tennant captured his kind of curiosity of old, although kind of hilariously, Donna being snarky, points out, she doesn't recognize him right away.
Right,
like, the memory doesn't just flood back.
Right, right.
And I'm not going to spoil anything big, but that's right there in the opening.
Yeah.
She does say, she's like, oh, hello there, Mr., you know, guy she runs into the street. She's like, Mr. Guy in a very tight suit or whatever.
Yeah.
And then points out that the particular style he's wearing probably shouldn't be worn by anyone over the age 35.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he kind of looks at her like, how dare you?
There's an alien, the alien spaceship lands. Donna's daughter gets involved with a cute little creature called the Meep.
Yep. And it seems it's like being hunted.
It's being hunted by some bug aliens. And the military and alien unit of England is involved. There's a woman in a wheelchair who's like, she doesn't know the Doctor, but she clearly knows.
Kind of like him. The new director.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff. I don't want to say too much about the second half of it because it does.
For sure. We'll leave.
Good twists and turns and stuff like that. But ultimately, I think it's a really good adaptation. It's a lot of fun. A lot of good technobabble stuff.
Yep.
And the way they leave off with Donna and her daughter and the way they resolve Donna's can she remember the Doctor thing is very satisfying.
Yes, there's a lot of good sequences in there, a lot of funny stuff, a lot of sort of heartfelt stuff. I felt like for an hour episode, you get a lot.
Yes, yeah, and it's a quick watch.
Yeah, if you just wanted to dip your toe back in, like I was kind of doing, I think you'll find you'll like it. Now I definitely want to see the next two episodes.
Yeah. Well, what is not a quick watch is the show that both of you all watched, Oppenheimer.
Yep.
So
I watched it like months ago in the Barbenheimer days.
Yes.
And Barbieheimer?
It was Barbenheimer.
Okay, yeah. Yep. And Nick, you just got around to it recently, so it's going to be fresher on your mind.
So yes, it was. I will also, it is a 3-hour long movie. I will say though, it didn't feel it for me.
Yeah.
My father-in-law, we told him we were watching it, and he was like, "Oh, that's a really slow movie." Yeah. And I'm watching this kind of like, I don't feel this is slow. I feel this is very propulsive, and it's like
real intense in that sort of the way that, like, I'm going to say All the President's Men or something like that.
Yeah, well,
but like if you're not plugging into it, yeah, it probably feels slow.
It also has a very like Aaron Sorkin like quality to it because most of it is dialogue driven.
Right,
the characters.
And it's all pretty interesting scenes.
It's all pretty interesting scenes.
Nick, did I say this before when I talked about it maybe briefly that it does open with a sequence that when I saw it, I was like, this can't possibly be true, that he tried to poison one of his teachers when he was, like, in college. Literally, Randy, he's got, like, a syringe with, like, cyanide in it,
yep.
And he goes and he injects it into the apple on the guy's desk.
He basically is the last to leave because the professor makes him stay while they attend a lecture by Niels Bohr.
Right.
And then the next day he comes in and he's thought better of it. He's going to take the apple and he walks in and Niels Bohr has the apple in his hand and is about to take a bite out of it.
One of his heroes.
Yeah, one of his heroes. So, is this real?
I looked it up and like it is based on like a true anecdote. I think a story that even like Oppenheimer himself told. Now,
that's crazy.
It still seems wild, but I see why they opened with it because you're just like, oh, anything, it kind of shocked me out of my expectations. I was like, oh, this is a weird, quirky guy, and I don't know what to predict of him.
Right.
So, like, when it shows that he's, like, kind of as a guy who gets involved in, like, unions and stuff like that.
Yeah, unions and
becomes a socialism adjacent, which will scare a lot of people later, as it turns out.
Wasn't it the Spanish, there was a specific thing that he was like going to meetings about that was like socialist, but it was about the uprising.
Was it in the Spanish Civil War?
Yeah, Spanish Civil War.
Yeah,
and he was definitely like meeting with them and like giving them money to sort of help refugees and stuff.
Yeah.
It definitely feels like he had like an altruistic nature to him because he was Jewish.
Yeah,
I mean.
That's something else I didn't even know about it.
Yeah.
I know the name is just because it might be a bit of a giveaway, but, like, I just never thought about it.
Taking place in the sort of the uprising of Hitler.
The rise of fascism in Germany.
And he believes that he can build the first atomic bomb.
Right. The reason that they come to him is, like, essentially, Russia and, what, Germany?
Yeah,
is it?
They're all sort of...
They have a huge lead on it, and they're like, one of us is going to get to it first. And it's like, they're kind of like, they don't think that it could be them. And he's kind of got an ego.
He's got an ego.
I could make it be us.
Well, it's not even that.
Right?
It's just like if we don't do something now, we might not do it because they probably have they're faster at this because they've got a couple more scientists that are a little more like smarter than they are. So it's like this arms race, but he does have an ego. I felt a little more sympathetic.
He's got an ego throughout the whole movie.
He does, but this is also juxtaposed with a couple of different timelines. There's like him building the bomb, and then there's the aftermath of him like being not censured, but basically at a tribunal in basically a small room with a bunch of people.
Does it have to do with it? That's his security clearance, it's whether he basically still has high access security clearance. And they kind of strip away a lot, and like it's really, it turns out he thinks it's like a formality, but it turns out to be this actually rather grueling and brutal evisceration of his life.
And if I go any further without saying how good Cillian Murphy is, I feel like it's a detriment to him, because he is amazing as Oppenheimer. He is, he steals every scene.
It's his role of a lifetime.
I know that he's been, Nolan has like said, we'll get to a movie where you can really kind of shine, because he's been in most everything Nolan's ever done.
He tried on the Batman costume once upon a time. It didn't happen, but he tried it on.
We've all been there.
But
recently as last night, I was there.
I was really, the way this movie is cut, with like interspersing like bits of like the atoms bursting and contracting, just like randomly throughout the movie,
of these volatile forces in motion.
Well, like the screen vibrates when he's just kind of like sitting there thinking, and it's just this very kind of thought provoking. Just you can like see this tactile thing happening in his brain.
I will say I did see it in an IMAX theater, and although it was like sort of one of those like cheapy IMAX theaters, but it was still quite the experience.
Yeah. I had my volume turned up really loud, and Kaylee was like, you need to turn it down. I'm like, no.
The one of the highlight sequences is the first test of the atomic bomb.
Yep.
And that comes at, like, I feel like roughly the two-thirds point of the movie. And then there is still, like, an hour left. And that's when you kind of find out the part of the movie that probably you didn't know was going to be about and has heavy inclusion of Robert Downey.
Well, yeah, Robert Downey Jr.
Also does, like, an Oscar turn role.
Yeah. I did not quite know, because my history of knowledge of this history is kind of like, meh, it's there. Yeah. But I don't know.
Oppenheimer was the guy who made the bomb, the end.
I didn't know, was it Braun? Or what is, who does
Mark Braun.
Now, who does Robert Downey Jr. play? Is it?
Oh, man, I won't remember the name.
But he's a senator.
It's not Von Braun, is it?
No, no, he's a senator. Basically, he was, like, put in charge of, like, things. He was the one who suggested Oppenheimer, but then he becomes sort of adversarial to him.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Robert Downey Jr. gives a fantastic performance.
What was impressive is how
multi-layered.
The movie kind of presents him one way in like roughly the first half, and you're not quite sure motivations and where he's headed with it all, and then you get a more definitive picture of him in the second half. I did find that despite the movie getting close to this person, there was a little bit of that Christopher Nolan distance I still always feel in his movies from his, like, clockwork-like construction of things, where I felt a little bit removed from him at some point. In a way, I thought that was okay, though, because he seemed like a hard guy to know.
Yeah, I think that is too. But I felt like this was the more fleshed-out character than I've seen Nolan do. Most of his other characters, like from Inception and
Prestige. He created all those characters from his mind, and this was a real person whose events he had to at least.
And maybe that's the case. I know he's definitely like projecting himself onto Oppenheimer a little bit, because he's kind of got that ego as well.
I too am a genius with the weight of all of cinema on my shoulders, just like he was.
But I felt like this was a more, I mean, weirdly fleshed out character. Didn't feel like that surface level, like Leonardo DiCaprio in Inception. Or
has a couple affairs in it, doesn't he?
Well, he has one big affair, with Florence Pugh, and he has a relationship with her. She is a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I can't remember which, but struggling with depression and things like that herself.
Yep.
And he sort of kind of gives her an ultimatum, say, because he always tells her, "I'll always come when you need me." And then he gives her an ultimatum and said, "I will not come anymore." And she ends up, like, taking her own life.
Yeah.
And that kind of destroys him in some regards. That does not go over well with his wife, played by Emily Blunt.
Right.
Who actually, I think, did a really good job with the character she was given.
Lots of good supporting characters in this.
God, there's so many people who show up in this movie, from James Remar to Matt Damon. Jack Quaid shows up at one point.
Oh, that's right.
The one criticism I'll give Nolan is I wish his female characters were a little more well-rounded.
Yeah.
They all feel kind of one note
little bit like sometimes they are appendages to the guys.
Yeah, unfortunately, he can't escape that. What was Leonardo DiCaprio's wife's name in Inception? Basically, that character. It's the same character over and over.
Right.
And I feel like I know Christopher Nolan is married and happily married.
Yeah.
And I just don't know why he's so stuck on this one kind of like circular Ouroboros.
Yeah. Some directors get hung up on their thing, like Spielberg and divorce.
That's
and
true.
Things like that.
However.
So Nick, you would recommend the movie?
I loved this movie. It is his best. I will watch it again.
Will you watch Oppenheimer 2?
I will watch Oppenheimer 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Dave, did you like this movie?
Yeah, I would say so. I think on my Letterboxd thing, when I get down to the nitty-gritty of what did I give it, I think I wavered between, and this is a five-star scale with half stars allowed, I wavered, I think, between 4 stars and 3.5, because and I might have landed on 3.5. Now, I feel like it's better than that. I feel like it's probably a 4-star movie, but the part of me that sometimes is resistant to Nolan is
that.
Just not willing to give it to him. I'm just like, you can't have it, Nolan, until you make a movie with real humans and not robots. Just kidding. This movie is pretty good about that. There's just something about his construction. He's always building towards this ringing bell clock, like as if it really was a clock. Wow. And I can feel the gears turning and pushing the things around.
I also said the one thing I really, really enjoyed was to see how connected the community of science was.
Yeah.
It's like Oppenheimer was actually friends with Einstein and could talk to him. And, like, all these other people that you're like, oh, I know that name, I know that name.
Right,
they were all talking.
I recognized the dude who was, like, something Drake, who was the guy who comes up with the Drake equation.
Yeah.
And, like you wouldn't think that we know as many physics people as we do, but, like, several of those names, I was like, oh, I've heard of that guy. Oh, I at least know this name, even if I don't know any details. I'm like, oh, yeah, there's famous physics people.
Oh, and, like, one of his best friends was Josh Hartnett, Josh Hartnett played, I forget what the actual person's name was, but I hadn't seen Josh Hartnett in a movie in forever, since Sin City, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
but, yes, I think I gave it, like, 4 or 4.5 with a heart, because I really enjoyed it, but Randy will never watch this.
No, I was thinking about this. I don't like biopics. I don't really like Nolan. I don't really want a 3.5-hour movie.
Just three hours.
Definitely don't want a 3-hour movie. Do y'all think I would like this? I just don't think I'd like it. I don't think it's.
I think there's a possibility because you do like Sorkin. It's kind of just like.
But Sorkin didn't write this.
No, but it has that quality. It has that vibe.
Okay. You know what I'd say?
There's lots of walk and talk.
Randy, watch like 10 or 15 minutes of it. Just like watch the opening and just see if it. I'd be curious to just know if that holds any appeal. I think 10 or 15 minutes would tell you if you kind of like it or are interested in its vibe or not.
Is that when Oppenheimer fights off of Thanos?
That's when Oppenheimer injects an apple with death juice.
Okay, that's pretty good. I might at some point. I considered watching it because y'all have watched it. And I was like, well, I'm not going to talk about it. But last night I got home and I was like, I do not want to watch a 3-hour biopic by Nolan.
In some ways, I'm like, I think it is a useful thing, like on a, you know, on the eat your peas and carrots kind of level of like to know about how our country became the superpower it did. And I would rather kind of, to some degree, learn it this way than with a slightly dry history textbook. Not that every history textbook is dry. I've read good history stuff. But, I felt like this was a good way for me to sample that I felt would be fairly well-rooted in reality, something that is still relevant.
I want to throw out a question to you, though, Dave. Is this a biopic? Or is this a movie about arms race.
It feels more like it's a slice of the early arms race. Yeah,
it doesn't go into like his younger days or there's not
very
kind
brief
of
glimpses.
Yeah, you get like tangential information here and there.
Yeah, you're gonna see him going to a sock hop in the 50s or having his first birthday party.
Like an arms race.
And you're like, oh, when he's picking mushrooms out in the forest, and he's like, I could make a bomb of this. That doesn't happen.
That was like the Brett Ratner version.
Well,
of Oppenheimer.
I wanted to see that version.
Oppenheimer the comedy.
I could make a bomb of this. It was all about the mushroom cloud.
Oh, dear.
I want to talk about an audiobook that I've just finished listening to.
Uh-huh.
It is called How to Be Perfect, Making the Correct Perfect Moral Decisions or something like that, by Mike Schur, the showrunner of Parks and Rec and The Good Place.
Yep.
And this came out of his work on The Good Place, where he started getting some moral philosophy. This is a book about moral philosophy. It is sort of an introduction to moral philosophy. So he talks about...
So you don't want to read autobiographies, but you will give us these philosophical treatises.
I will. He talks about Aristotle. He talks about... God, who's the German philosopher? Who's a Kant?
Yep.
Okay.
And I feel like there's one other notable big one. And then he also goes in and talks about Scanlon, who did What We Owe to Each Other. A lot of the stuff that was in the underpinnings of The Good Place. He talks about the philosoph. He read a lot of that philosophy stuff. And this is sort of a sort of like, how do we be good people? How would each philosopher do this? And it's really interesting. It's actually an interesting book about, like, you know, what do you do in a day? How do you apply ethics to your day-to-day life? But it's Mike Schur, so it's also loaded down with jokes. It's very funny. There's a great bit in this audio book where basically they use a audio tone to indicate going to a footnote, and then another audio tone to indicate returning to the text.
Hmm.
And the footnotes are all, he's like, the footnotes are to give context, or honestly, mostly to do jokes. And there's...
Well, they have guest readers or something.
He reads
for
most
those.
Of it, but the entire cast of The Good Place reads bits and pieces.
I was going to say, this seems like a book that Chidi, like, wrote or something.
Yeah.
By the way, the full title is How to Be Perfect, The Correct Answer to Every Moral Question.
Yes, which gives you a sense of the sort of tongue-in-cheekness of it all.
Yeah.
It's very good. He talks about, like, everything from, like, he talks about, like, how do we forgive, you know, where's our line drawn for celebrities who have broken faith with us? Like, what do you know? He talks about Chick-fil-A and sort of where that all is. And
okay, so it's stuff that kind of weaves through our real world.
Yes.
And not just,
applied
some
philosophy.
Abstract
it
problem.
It is applied philosophy.
That sounds interesting.
And it's really good. I actually really enjoyed it, and it's a ton of fun. It made me laugh every chapter. And the audiobook is, if you have Spotify Premium, it's free.
Okay.
Because they've got a ton of audio books on there. Yeah.
You might have said that before, but it didn't register. I have Spotify Premium.
Premium. They have a ton of audiobooks on there.
I guess I ought to look into that.
Yeah, I've got to start listening to more audiobooks because they're all included in my subscription price.
Huh. Kaylee has that. I should probably
use that. Where's the listen? Anyway.
Sitting right there for us.
There's a bunch of stuff on there, but this one in particular, I picked it out, wanted to read it, and was very happy with it.
Nice.
If you like The Good Place, I would recommend How to Be Perfect.
Yeah.
Dave, I know you also listened to a Spotify Premium thing.
Yes, I did. As I was looking at some comics last night that were this week's DC comics, I came across an ad in the back of, I think, most DC books this week for the Spotify audio series called The Riddler, Secrets in the Dark. Literally, this is, I guess they've made some other ones before, but I don't know if I've ever really given them a serious shake.
Right.
And it had a little QR code, and I was like, I could scan a QR code. So I scanned that, and it took me right to my Spotify, and I listened to the first episode. Okay. And I really liked it.
Okay.
This is indeed... I'm going to read you what the back page promotion for it says. A masked vigilante is on the loose, murdering notorious supervillains all over Gotham City. And all the clues point to the suspect being the Caped Crusader himself, Batman. Now, with a target on his head, the charming yet deadly Edward Nygma, better known as the Riddler, is forced to break out of Arkham Asylum and solve the mystery before he, too, becomes a victim. That is a solid description of it, but what mainly happens in the first episode is you get kind of a little, almost like day in the life of the Riddler in Arkham, where he's, goes through sort of, you see him palling around with Killer Croc.
Okay.
And by the way, this comes with this is an R-rated series. Like, the F-bomb is dropped in this.
Okay.
But not, like, so commonly that I feel like they're, you know, kind of leaning obnoxiously into it. But he's, like, cellmates or cell adjacent to Croc. And so Croc is a little bit of the sounding board. And actually, the scripting is surprisingly good. I like the characterization of Croc a lot.
Okay.
That hearing the two of them talk is a lot of fun. And I was pleased that Croc looks like he's going to continue to play a role in the series.
The thing that I worried about from the imagery from this was, like, I was worried this was going to be like the Dark Knight Riddler, the guy from the movie. Remember the murderous Riddler?
Oh, right, from the current Batman movie.
And is this more of the smart Riddler?
So he's voiced by Hasan Minhaj.
Oh, huh.
So that's okay. For starters, there's that. Comedian Hasan Minhaj.
Yeah.
What is he best known for?
Daily Show. His one-man show.
And they are, to me, in some ways he feels like the classic Riddler to me. There's a touch more edge because this series has a touch more edge to it, but like, when it begins, like, you can see he's doing things, certain things to manipulate the guards, but he also gets a shakedown from Detective Flass, who's been adapted in, like, one of the movies, but people who've read Batman Year One know him. This is a different take on him, but he's still, like, piece of shit Gotham cop.
Okay, yeah.
And he shakes him down hard, and he's kind of like, you know, as smart as you are, you know, like, you're not smarter than me. And their confrontation is, like, the serious crux of the thing. And then there's also an interesting thing where he's got a correspondence going on with Calendar Man, who's, like, at, like...
What is it with Calendar Man and Riddler that sort of, like, they seem to link up in
you know what's
stories.
Interesting is, what I liked about this is it took a weirdo villain like Calendar Man and actually takes him kind of seriously. You hear Enigma read the letter he sent, which may or may not have some coded stuff in it.
Okay.
And it's kind of interesting. Their friendship is sort of interesting. Even, like... You know, there was a villain on the old 60s show, King Tut.
Yep.
I don't know if that guy ever made it to the comics in any real way. I think there is like one or two things, but nothing serious.
Yeah.
He briefly appears in this in a sequence which is like a group therapy sequence. And, like, that's a character nobody touches. But weirdly, I liked his treatment in it. Hmm. Like, they go by and they, you know, somebody like Killer Croc or somebody cracks wise about him, like, you know, ready to, you know, forge a new Egypt or something like that. And he's like, he's talking like he really does think he's a god. He's like, you laugh. He's like, but he's like, Croc, he's like, you know, and, you know, it's like under, you know, my world, you would be treated as a god, the great god of the mighty Nile. And he kind of takes it seriously. Yeah. He's not joking.
King Tut and Maxi Zeus should be in a group therapy session.
They should. But what's interesting, I thought the therapy session would be just jokes, and there is humor in this, for sure.
Yeah.
There is humor, but it's not like a series of wisecracks about, like, oh, what would it be like if Arkham people were in group therapy? It's like, it's actually a little more serious than that. And culminates in Riddler realizing that there's possibly somebody gunning for criminals. Seems like Batman is doing it. I'm betting it's not.
Probably
but
not.
Exactly what is going on is interesting. And him deciding he needs to take an active role into doing this before he ends up dead.
How long was the episode?
30 minutes.
Okay.
Or maybe a little less.
Okay.
Some of their other voice casting, that sounds interesting.
I saw other... I didn't look up any of the other actors. So
Coleman Domingo, Gina Rodriguez from Jane the Virgin and Not Dead Yet, and a bunch of other stuff.
Huh. Okay.
But yeah, I really liked it. It was... I was surprised at how well written it was, and like how strong the script was, and how good the voice acting was. Again, particular kudos to Riddler himself and to Killer Croc, who was characterized in a way that I hadn't really quite heard before. So,
okay.
Give it a shot. It's also darkly funny at times.
All right. Yeah, I may give this a shot now that I've finished.
And again, people will see the ad for it in this week's DC Comics, so you can just scan it. But it's called The Riddler, Secrets in the Dark.
I guess now that I've finished my Egghead book about moral philosophy, I can listen to a Riddler.
You can listen to one supervillain podcast as a treat.
Let's see. Do y'all want to talk about Lost Voyage of the Demeter?
Sure. I mean, I can real quick.
Yeah.
So Lost Voyage of the Demeter is a movie directed by Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark director. I cannot think of his name.
He's a guy who made a bunch of movies that we've liked. So
yeah, he has a good
Troll
track record.
Hunter, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, and The Autopsy of Jane Doe are the big ones.
Yep.
And then this is his latest, and it bombed at the theaters. Nick, did you feel, did it deserve to bomb?
I think it did, sadly. I think there was some... So basically, this is the chapter from Bram Stoker's Dracula that is about his voyage from...
Yeah, where Dracula's coffin is transported from, like, Transylvania to England.
To England.
And he ends up killing everybody on the ship.
Correct.
Which does lead to a awesome... Some very metal descriptions in the book. I think the book ends with the ship crashing on the shore, and they find the captain lashed to the wheel with his throat torn out.
Yep.
And so it's like, in a way, we all know how this kind of has to end... But there is a kind of question as you're watching the movie as to whether some people might survive secretly and just not be, like, on board when it crashes.
Right.
And also, you know, when you're watching it, you're like, I don't know how faithful they're going to be. Maybe they're going to change it.
Turns out they're pretty faithful.
Fairly faithful, but there are some twists.
There are some twists. It just didn't have any... It was well shot. It was well thought out. It's just a little dry.
Yeah, I agree. It didn't have just enough oomph.
Right.
Did you find, Nick, I thought it was pretty cool when they had, because, you know, in the book, the what do you call it, Romani? Mm-hmm. That like he's like enslaved some of them. Essentially, they're his servants.
Yeah,
you know, there's something no doubt kind of xenophobic about that. That would have amounted to people being like afraid of gypsies. Yeah. That's how they would have put it back then.
Well, they like deliver his coffin and like several other things. Like,
they're the ones who carry it, like their caravan to the ship,
but they won't load it on.
Won't load it on. And I really liked that sequence.
Did too.
I was like kind of instantly on board from how that sequence was handled. And then you meet the people on the docks who are the people who are going in, which includes a doctor who's a person of color.
Yep.
Who ends up getting the spot of somebody else who gets, what, injured? Is that what happened?
Well, no. Basically, one of the like strong people get on the boat. He takes the place. He ends up saving the captain's son.
Right.
From like a piece of, like one of, some piece of article that they're loading from crushing him. Basically pushes him out of the way. And the captain, like, played by the Onion Knight or Ser Davos from Game of Thrones.
Yeah, great casting.
Yeah,
by the way,
he's great.
You probably couldn't ask for a better guy to have mutton chops in a movie.
That's true.
Than Ser Davos.
But it's just a little dry.
Yeah.
I don't think it's bad.
No. In some ways, like, the trailer showed what it was going to be, which is, we know a number of the cast, but there's also some sailors and stuff on board who are minor characters you don't know too much about. And you're like, oh, I guess he's going to start picking off people one by one, and it's going to be kind of secret for a while, and then they're going to kind of realize what's going on and maybe start to fight against it. And that's exactly what happens. Yeah.
Then a dog gets killed. I was a little sad by that.
Yeah, you know.
And then all the livestock gets killed, and I was a little sad by that. And then the people started killing, and I was like, I expected that.
I think where we both agreed they did a good job was just the atmosphere, that sort of nautical vibe.
They have
feel like they're trapped kind of out there.
They have like the crew have a call and response kind of thing that they do. So
like you do a little knock knock on a like a deck, like one of the board planks or something like that, and then you're supposed to get an answering call from down below.
It they just set that, up some cool stuff.
Right, they use that in the sort of the same way the motion trackers are used in Aliens for the occasional, like, is there somebody down there or not? Are you okay or are you not?
And it all looks good. I thought the cinematography was great, as I expected it would be. Mm-hmm. I thought Dracula looked cool. Just kind of, like, sort of feral Dracula.
Yep. Right, they even showed this in the trailers, that he's a pretty monstrous bat monster-looking thing at times. And yeah, there's definitely a question of, like, you know, yes, is there any way it's possible to stop this dude?
Yeah.
The movie ends on a note that I kind of liked.
Yeah.
The epilogue sequence, which is set in England in a tavern.
Yep.
Something like that. And arguably breaks canon a little bit, but, like, as far as, like, the public knows, like, you wouldn't know who all survived necessarily.
Right.
Like, if they weren't there on the shore, on the ship, when all the people went out to do a rescue or whatever, then you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I kind of like this little sequence that bookends it. But yes, an underwhelming movie, I agree.
If we're going with our Letterboxd, I think I gave it 2 stars.
Yeah, sounds about right. In a charitable mood, I could give it 2.5.
Yeah.
I
don't think it was a bad time, but it's one of those where I would just wait for it to hit, like, HBO.
I doubt I'll revisit it, but I will watch scenes from it. Or, like, if it was, like, on, I'd probably watch bits and pieces. Because it is kind of watchable.
It is.
If you're, like, a creature feature kind of person, I might... I'd give it a loose recommendation for that category if you kind of want to see a monster.
All right. Well, I think that'll wrap it up for us this week.
Yep.
We'll be back next week in the morning. So that time,
yo, Joe.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.